Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life, and by the Coriell Institute for Medical Research.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. My conversation with Katie Hunt starts simple enough.
I was just making a copy of two labels to give to you of my favorite energy drink, chocolate milk.
Katie is a retired chemist. Well, she says she failed at retirement and now teaches at the University of Virginia. And we're looking at some food labels together. Chocolate milk, which she likes and I don't.
When I look at a label, I start with calories, right?
Sure, me too. From there, there's milk, cocoa, sugar. But remember, Katie is a chemist.
So a simple sugar has six carbons, C6H12O6, right? And so no double bonds in there.
I'm beginning to feel a little lost, but at least I know what sugar is. I mean, most of these things I feel familiar with, right? Mm-hmm. But then I read words like carrageenan. Am I even saying that right?
Yes.
What is that?
So carrageenan would be something that's added as a thickener. Carrageenan would be a natural product that is extracted.
From red seaweed, to be exact. And from there, this chocolate milk label quickly becomes totally incomprehensible for me. And that's true for lots of labels on food, supplements, medicine. It all sounds like chemicals, to which Katie says, yeah, of course.
Everything around us is chemicals. We are made of chemicals. We are very large percentage of us is dihydrogen oxide.
What's that?
That's water.
Okay. And what other chemicals are me?
The blood, the hemoglobin in our blood, and whether it has iron or not, whether it is oxygenated or not. And I mean, the air we breathe is chemicals.
But understanding what kinds of chemicals are present and how they are put together is really important. For example,
the kind of alcohol that you find in beer and wine is ethyl alcohol. But we also use alcohol in the form of rubbing alcohol. And that is isopropyl alcohol. So that has only one more carbon, but that, if ingested, can cause blindness. So you don't want to confuse thinking that alcohol is alcohol or that this clear liquid is the same as other clear liquids.
One carbon can make a huge difference. Something called alcohol can be several different things. It's important that we know ingredients, that we understand what's in our food, in our medicine, or supplements. On today's episode, check the label. Let's start with supplements. Americans take tons of them, and there's a kind of supplement that's really popular among bodybuilders and weightlifters. These pills and powders have names like Shredder, Hyperdrive, Animal Rage XL. That sounds pretty intense, right? These products promise to boost performance and endurance, but researchers and regulators say what's in them could be dangerous or even deadly. Liz Tung has more.
I'm at the gym with Kevin Kreider. He's a model and fitness life coach, plus a former bodybuilder. And he's showing me his daily workout.
So I always start off with the heaviest, hardest, most difficult movement first.
He slides some weights onto either side of the lifting bar and locks them into place. And then he hoists it up.
And you just grab the bar like this.
He lifts it a little higher.
Hoo-ah!
And then drops it back on the ground. And then he does that a few more times. His teeth are clenched, his eyes are bugging out, his muscles are shaking.
I don't know. What? Seems like everything is like a hernia waiting to happen in here.
I know, it's kind of a disaster. That's why they made you sign that waiver before you got in.
To me, it's kind of terrifying. But some people live for this stuff. Weightlifters, bodybuilders, even everyday gym rats who just want to look good. They spend hours here lifting weights, which requires an insane amount of energy and endurance. Today, Kevin's just running on a cup of black coffee, but for about 7 years, he relied on something else, a kind of supplement called pre-workout.
Yeah, the first pre-workout I ever took was, I think, 2006, and this stuff was just like crack to me.
Kevin had just graduated from college and was getting into bodybuilding, which is super competitive. And he said people were telling him that pre-workout could take him and his workouts to the next level.
It numbs the pain down so you can get that extra rep or two, and you want to do every single rep possible. You're going to have that laser-like focus. You're going to lift more. You're going to get big. You're going to also lose fat and shred at the same time. And it was like all these promises that sound awesome.
Back then, pre-workout was kind of the hot new thing. And today, more than 10 years later, you can see it everywhere. It's sold at gyms, GNCs, online. You can get it in capsule form, but most people buy it in these flavored drink powders. There are tons of different brands, but most contain the same basic ingredients. Amino acids to boost your muscles, and caffeine for energy. Kevin noticed the energy part right away.
I remember taking my first serving, and I was just like so hyper and energized. I loved it. And I literally had such a great workout. I was making more noise than normal because I was going past and I wanted to do more. And I could have, even though I was working out for like an hour and a half that day. I was like, I want to do more.
But he couldn't switch the energy off.
And then literally I remember in my bed, it was like 2 a.m. and I was like, I can't go to sleep. Like, obviously I was worried because my mind was going 1,000 thoughts per minute. But it did feel euphoric. It felt like I was high. I literally stayed up almost 24 hours, and then I had an hour and a half nap, and I still felt jacked up the next day. And so it became more addictive for me because I was like, I want that back.
And so Kevin kept taking the pre-workout. In the beginning, just before he went to the gym, but as time went by, he started taking it every day, and then a few times a day, and then as soon as he got up.
Sometimes I'd have maybe a little bit more than I was supposed to. You know, you're supposed to only have like one to three scoops. I'd be like, okay, I'm going to have 3.5. Okay, 4.
He thought it was safe, even good for him. It was just supposed to have caffeine and those amino acids to boost his muscles. But as it turned out, the pre-workout Kevin was using had an extra ingredient, a stimulant called DMAA. It acts like an amphetamine, speed basically, and was banned by the Food and Drug Administration a few years ago. The FDA has tried cracking down, but there are dozens of pre-workout supplements that contain DMAA and other stimulants.
It's countless. It's countless. Yeah, I can't keep track of them.
That's Peter Cohen. He's a doctor at the Cambridge Health Alliance, and he also teaches at Harvard Medical School. But mostly, he's known for being a supplement detective. For 10 years, he's been testing supplements, especially pre-workouts, to find out what's in them. He's found dozens that contain stimulants, and he says there are plenty more out there.
The anti-doping experts tell me that there's over 1,000 different supplements on their list at present.
Their list of performance-enhancing substances that athletes aren't allowed to take, either because they offer an unfair advantage or because they're dangerous. Some have never even been tested on humans.
So it might be that something has a serious side effect, but we would have absolutely no idea.
Of course, there are lots and lots of people who take pre-workout without any problems, but there have also been reports of some pretty scary stuff. Heart attacks, stroke, liver failure. Plus,
chest pain, panic attack, heart racing, shortness of breath.
We've started seeing some of the fallout over the past few years. Class action lawsuits from consumers claiming injuries from taking these pre-workouts. There have also been several well-publicized deaths linked to pre-workout. But Peter says it's just a small part of a larger problem with the supplement industry. He says one CDC estimate suggests
about 23,000 people end up in the emergency room every year due to supplements.
So you might be asking why the FDA isn't doing something about these workout supplements that are putting people in the hospital. Josh Sharfstein is a public health professor at Johns Hopkins and a former deputy commissioner at the FDA. And he says,
the FDA does not know what's on the market.
Thanks to a law passed in 1994, the FDA isn't allowed to regulate supplements the same way it regulates drugs. Even when regulators figure out something bad's going on with a supplement, the burden's on the government to prove that that's the case, using lab tests, which Josh says are expensive and time-consuming. Plus,
there's research that even after ingredients are banned, that they're still found in dietary supplements, the exact ingredient that was banned.
But there does seem to be a growing consciousness of the dangers. Case in point, our fitness coach and model, Kevin. About a year and a half ago, he quit using pre-workout, and he posted a video on YouTube explaining why.
First of all, I don't get that morning hangover anymore from not taking a pre-workout supplement. I was starting to take pre-workout supplements first thing in the morning just to get myself out of bed anymore. It's ridiculous.
But on the whole, pre-workout is still hugely popular. And Peter Cohen, the supplement detective, says internet sales are just making the problem worse. But Peter says there is one way to fix the situation, changing the law to give the FDA more power.
At some point, I think that we're going to decide that we don't want to take pills and powders that are advertised as if they improve our health when they actually have no evidence that they work and might be putting our health at risk. So I think eventually consumers, Americans, are going to decide that this law is not working for us and we're going to see real change.
But let's say you still want to take pre-workout. What do you do? The FDA has a simple recommendation. Talk to your doctor first. For The Pulse, I'm Liz Tung.
We're talking about ingredients, why they matter, and why we should pay attention to labels. Thousands of people end up in the hospital every year because of a medication they're taking. Maybe they're dizzy, have a splitting headache, their pulse is racing. The problem is, lots of times, patients are unsure what medications they're taking.
They'll say, well, doc, I take two green pills and one blue pill, and then I do take a purple pill, I think.
That's Avir Mitra. He's an emergency room physician in New York City, and we check in with him every once in a while to hear what's happening in his world.
We see this all the time. You know, people are always having reactions to medications. You know, we don't always have access to their charts if they've been to different hospitals or their primary doctor isn't on the same health record system as us. We have no way of accessing that information.
That's because health records don't talk to each other.
It's like you have different competing companies and different competing hospitals, and they are not required to share data. So it's almost like if you have Gmail and I have like Yahoo email, like we can only send emails to other people with the same email as us, and we can't send emails to each other, you know? It's so dumb. I don't know, but that's just the way the system is set up.
If Avir suspects a patient is having a reaction to a medication, he has to try to piece everything together.
Okay, so at the end of the day, many patients that we see tend to be on similar medicines. Like a lot of patients are on beta blockers for their heart, or a lot of people are on blood thinners. So after a while of practicing, you start to see the same side effects over and over again. So you may see an older patient coming in who's complaining of dizziness, and usually you can figure out that, and you'll do tests also to see like, oh, their heart rate is going a little bit slower than it should be going. They're probably taking a beta blocker, maybe their dose is too high, and maybe that's what's causing them to feel dizzy.
It's rare that Avir can just type a patient's name into his computer and all that information pops up. Instead, he often finds himself calling up other healthcare providers, looking for clues.
You know, if you come in at 3 a.m, we may not be able to get in touch with anybody. Sometimes I've been on hold trying to get in touch with a different ER for like an hour, which is not practical, you know. On the corollary, you know, I would get calls all the time, like, can any available resident please pick up this phone? And all of us kind of just groan because we know it's going to be some outpatient doctor in the middle of nowhere being like, can you find this patient? Do you know what happened to them? Now you're like, you're digging through your own charts trying to figure out what happened to this patient. Meanwhile, you have your own patients to deal with. So it's so crazy to think about, especially to think that we live in, you know, it's 2018 and We know how technology works, and there's no reason that things should be this way.
He says the best thing we can do as patients is keep a list of all the medications we're taking and the dose, and also a list of all the medical procedures we've been through. Avir Mitra is an emergency room physician in New York City. Food labels can be confusing, but at least we have them. We can check out exactly what we're eating and drinking. And we have one man to thank for that, a chemist with a burning passion to make America's food supply safe. He relied on some very unusual and ruthless methods to achieve his goal. Shruti Pinnamaneni brings us his story.
Picture this. It's the winter of 1902. We're in Washington, D.C., in the basement of a government building. 12 young men, boys really, are sitting down to dinner. Their suits are neatly pressed and their mustaches are stiff with wax. Waiters are serving them courses like chipped beef, turnips, and celery on toast. But there's a problem with all this fancy food. It's been spiked with an unidentified poison. The men know this, but they go ahead and eat everything on their plates. The newspapers have a name for these guys. They are the Poison Squad. This ritual poisoning is actually a government project. Congress has signed off on it, and it will go on like this for years. The mastermind behind this experiment, he's standing at the head of the table, watching his boys eat. His name is Harvey Washington Wiley.
That's an early picture of him. Look at the homespun jacket and his derby hat.
Suzanne Junot is a historian at the Food and Drug Administration.
Wiley was born in 1844 in Indiana on a farm, and he decided fairly early, I think, that he didn't want to be a farmer.
Instead, Wiley went to a college nearby, bringing all his provisions from home. He writes in his biography,
"We brought potatoes, cornmeal, and sorghum molasses. We also brought butter from home and made arrangements with a German woman to bake our flour into bread."
But this intimate connection with food, knowing what was in your bread and your butter, this was all about to change by the 1900s.
50% of all Americans now lived in cities.
That's Melanie Warner. She wrote a book about processed foods called Pandora's Lunchbox.
They had moved off the farm, so they had to rely on other people that they didn't know, strangers, companies, to produce their food.
This food was all coming from far away places. There were tins of bright green peas or cans of gooey pink meat. The labels back then didn't always have a list of ingredients, so if you were staring at one of these cans trying to figure out what was in it, you could only guess. By this point, Wiley was 37 years old. He was working as state chemist of Indiana. He starts using this thing called a polariscope, which is basically a microscope that uses a special light source. He points his lens at this golden liquid from a tin labeled Pure Maple Syrup of Vermont and sees that
maple syrup has been displaced by glucose.
Cheap glucose from corn, nothing like the stuff that oozes out of a maple tree. In a can of green peas, he finds
sulfate of copper to give them a vivid green color.
Even pumpkin pie wasn't pumpkin pie anymore, but
mashed turnip, colored yellow, with annatto.
Now, keep in mind there were no laws against this at the time, so food companies could do pretty much anything they wanted.
They would take rotting meat and rotting eggs and doctor them up with chemical preservatives, passing them off as fresh meat.
So people were eating this rotten meat, except they didn't know that it was rotten or that it had been treated with borax, this white powder that we nowadays use to clean clothes or kill ants. They also didn't know that the milk they were drinking had been mixed in with formaldehyde. Dairy companies did that to keep old milk from going sour. By now, Wiley had worked his way up into a pretty powerful position. He was chief chemist of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. He had a hunch that these food chemicals were harmful, deadly even. But how could he prove it? The solution was obvious.
Fortunately, the Department of Agriculture is richly provided with subjects for experiments, if only their consent be obtained.
So Wiley recruited a dozen clerks and low-level employees. In exchange for free room and board, they signed a pledge that they will not hold the government responsible for any illness or accident, including death. And in December 1902, the experiments began. The men lived and ate in the Bureau of Chemistry.
A chef prepared the meals.
Roast lamb, 66 grams, potatoes.
And Wiley would spike these meals.
Peas, 50 grams.
With increasing doses of borax.
I gather peaches were used as dessert. Canned peaches, of course.
Everyone had to submit all their bodily fluids, their stool samples, urine samples, pretty much daily.
Wiley even built a special fecal drying machine to analyze the piles of evidence he was collecting.
With number 5, the constipation has given way to looseness of the bowels. 4 evacuations taking place during the day.
When they got too sick to continue the work, he would take them off the experiments and give them what he called clean food.
Number 5 is quite ill with a sick headache and diarrhea. No borax is administered on April 27th.
Over the course of 5 years, about 50 men served on the squad. Group by group, they ate borax, formaldehyde, salicylic acid, sulfuric acid, sodium benzoate, potassium nitrate. They lived with sharp stomach cramps, fevers, nausea. Several men dropped out midway, and one man never recovered and died months later in his mother's home.
An enterprising reporter got wind that this was happening in the Bureau of Agriculture, and he started interviewing the chef through a basement window. And once he wrote the story, he actually gave them the name the Poison Squad.
The public couldn't get enough. The news stories about the squad bounced between outrageous and outraged. There were headlines like Poison Eater Dead or Salicylic Acid Hurts. And after years of this, the stories paid off. Wiley finally got what he wanted, a food law, a big one.
How does a general feel who wins a great battle and brings a final end to hostilities? I presume I felt that way on the last day of June, 1906.
That's the day that Congress passed the Pure Food and Drug Act. This law would lay the grounds for what would eventually become the FDA. Now, for the first time, food companies could be fined if they lied on their labels, and states could ban specific chemicals from food, which many did. Wiley resigned from his government job in 1912, but he didn't stop fighting for this ideal of pure food. He spent his remaining years writing for the magazine Good Housekeeping, where he became famous for his seal of approval and his diatribes against tobacco and Coca-Cola and bleached white flour and high fructose corn syrup and saccharin and gelatin and food dyes.
I've always stood for food that is food.
I'm Shruti Pindamaneni.
This story was part of the PRX STEM Story Project with support from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, editing and sound design by Brendan Baker. There's also a new book out about Dr. Wiley. It's called The Poison Squad. The author is Deborah Blum, and one of her favorite examples of food fakery from Wiley's time is coffee.
People would make fake coffee beans out of dirt and wax and mix them into the coffee bean bag or barrel that you might pick up. There was actually a joke that the origin of the phrase, a muddy cup of coffee, was related to the fact that there used to be so much actual mud in coffee in the 19th century.
So that was a long time ago, but how are we doing with this now? When I'm at the grocery store, am I getting what I think I'm buying?
You know, yes and no. We certainly, for the most part, I believe, when we are buying a bag of flour, we're not buying a bag of mixed flour and stone, I hope.
Right.
But when you go out and you look at some specific ingredients, like olive oil, there's all kinds of random independent testing that shows that often olive oil is cottonseed oil that's dyed a little green and has a little bit of spice to it and is sold as olive oil. And so that's something where you know that fraud continues and we've got the apparatus to catch it and we don't fully enforce it. So one of the myths of regulation is that, you know, the government is always jackbooting around with a boot enforcing these things, and that's not true because a lot of this system is underfunded. We don't have the inspections to always do this, right?
You spend a lot of time with Wiley, with his work and his papers. How are you thinking differently now about labels and food and what you consume and how you consume?
Well, I'm slightly more cynical and a little bitter, right? So, which probably pretty much described Harvey Wiley at the end of his career. I mean, once you actually go back and you look at this, you really do recognize what a thin, fragile net of consumer protection exists.
Have you changed your mind on any particular food, or is there something that you now no longer eat or you avoid?
I was in the grocery store here in Massachusetts, and I was looking at, it was like a bottle of lemon juice, because I can be a really lazy cook because I work all the time, right? And I thought, maybe, and I'm reading the ingredients on this bottle of lemon juice, and the last ingredient is sodium benzoate, which is a really commonly used preservative that Wiley really went to the mat to try to get taken out of the food supply. And there's not a ton of evidence that it's anything particularly lethal, but I stood in the produce department of my grocery store, and I said, you know, I'm going to buy fresh lemons, right? Why should I add more of this into my diet? Why don't I just go and actually take a few minutes and squeeze the lemon and get the real thing? That was a big shift for me, and I found myself, post this book, much more of a label reader. And I'm a science writer, I'm a toxicology writer. I don't fully understand everything on a label either, right? But the stuff that I do recognize, I tend to respond to more, and so I just read labels more.
Deborah Blum's new book is The Poison Squad, One Chemist's Single-Minded Crusade for Food Safety at the Turn of the 20th Century. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. When it comes to ingredients in our food, there is one that's a big red flag for nutritionists: sodium. Too much of it can contribute to high blood pressure, stroke, or heart disease. These are all major health problems in Philadelphia, and in recent years, Philly city officials have set their sights on reducing sodium. They are focusing these efforts on Chinese takeout restaurants, which are often located in predominantly African-American and Latino neighborhoods. It makes sense. A lot of Chinese takeout food is high in sodium, and African-Americans have higher rates of heart disease than other groups. But there is some pushback against this approach. We sent Nina Feldman to get some dinner.
So I'm in West Philly, and I'm going to check out Choi Wong. Chinese and American food is what the sign says, with a phone number. I've actually always wanted to try this place. I used to live around the corner.
On my way here, I passed two other Chinese takeout spots, just a few blocks away. And there's another one around the corner. This is not unusual for certain neighborhoods in the city. There are more than 400 Chinese takeout places in Philadelphia. That's more than the number of Burger King's, Wendy's, McDonald's, Pizza Hut's, and KFC's combined.
Hi.
When I walked into Choi Wong, I met this guy, George Walker, who works nearby and knows what's good in the neighborhood.
I like the egg. I like the egg for young. I like the pork chop. General tofu is delicious.
General so tofu?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, maybe I'll try that.
And then the beef broccoli is delicious with the fried rice. Ooh, now you're talking.
At George's recommendation, I went with the General Tso, which has about half of my recommended sodium for the day. Plus, I got some dumplings.
Steamed or fried?
Steamed.
Okay. That's it?
Yep.
Okay, $10.
The plentiful Chinese food options in the neighborhood were exactly what caught the eye of Philadelphia's former mayor a few years ago. That was the start of the idea for the Healthy Chinese Takeout Initiative.
They noticed these like yellow signs all down the street, and Mayor Nutter was like, what are those signs for?
That's nutritionist Jennifer Aquilante from the city's public health department.
And they looked closer and realized they were takeout restaurants. He's like, wow, there's so many takeout, these Chinese takeout restaurants around. We should do something with those.
Beginning in 2012, the city worked with restaurant owners to help them use less soy sauce and fewer other seasonings high in sodium. They focused on their three most popular dishes, chicken lo mein, shrimp and broccoli, and General Tso chicken. Restaurant owners were trained by a professional chef on ways to alter their recipes and make sure the food stayed tasty.
Even just a little bit of a sodium reduction, I think it's like 600 to 900 milligrams, you could still see a reduction in your blood pressure points.
there was no financial incentive, and the program was completely voluntary. Still, about 200, or half of all Chinese takeout places, signed up. Researchers at Temple University's Center for Asian Health studied the effort. A year and a half after the owners first changed their recipes, they were still making the dishes with an average of about 25% less sodium. The study didn't measure actual health benefits for the customers, so there's no way to know if sodium intake actually went down. Diners could have just ordered different dishes, added salt, or eaten at different restaurants. The city did conduct taste tests as a part of its study, and Jennifer says customers couldn't tell the difference between dishes before and after. Ling Lin runs a takeout place in North Philly, a predominantly African-American neighborhood. Her place, King Wok, is working with the city. Ling says her customers did notice when her cooks began using less soy sauce, and that made her nervous.
So first of all, we worry about it. We will be losing the customer.
But when she started talking to people about why the change, they got on board.
When we explain for the customer, they understand. We help them.
But I was curious. Does a program designed just for Chinese takeout places make owners feel targeted? Why not also work with pizza parlors or cheesesteak places? When I asked Ling, she switched to Mandarin to explain. Ling says she doesn't feel singled out. Her customers value healthy food. So if the city can help her make her dishes healthier, great. Okay, so this approach checks out from a public health perspective. Go to where the problem is. But some worry that an effort like this bears a striking resemblance to another time in our history, when Chinese restaurants were targeted for using certain ingredients. Here's food and science historian Sarah Tracy.
Anytime you do that, you start with an ethnic group first. In the name of a health initiative, you're helping to shore up those boundaries of racial or ethnic difference.
Sarah's writing a book about the history of MSG, or monosodium glutamate. That's a chemical compound used in lots of Chinese food. It's in plenty of other foods, too, like Doritos, Campbell's soup, and KFC. It adds that savory umami quality that keeps you going back for more. In the late 1960s, MSG came under fire in the medical world. Sarah says this happened after a Chinese-American doctor wrote a letter to the New England Journal of Medicine, which said,
I've been having these symptoms when I go to certain Chinese-American restaurants. I get numbness, I get tingling, flushing in my neck. And I'm wondering, fellow physicians, is this something that you have encountered in your practice? Are your patients telling you that they're experiencing this?
Sarah says that from there, a sort of panic cropped up about MSG in Chinese food. And the symptoms the doctor described became known as Chinese restaurant syndrome. Chefs were quick to boast that they cooked without it because they didn't want to lose customers. Later, in the 90s, the FDA commissioned a study to look at MSG's adverse health effects. It turned out there weren't many. For a very small subset of people, MSG can cause a bad reaction. But for most, it's safe. Sarah doesn't think the hysteria was really about food.
It was also about fears around migrant populations and what kind of America are we living in? Who is American? How do immigrants influence what kind of America we want to create in the future?
The MSG scare was around the same time there was an influx of Chinese and other Asian immigrants to the United States. Sarah says intolerance for these new groups stoked the fear around MSG. Now, even after the FDA has shown that MSG isn't harmful, Sarah says the damage has already been done. Chinese food and Chinese culture is often still linked with an additive perceived to be toxic.
Okay, same as anybody.
Great, thank you.
As I'm waiting for my food, I'm thinking about all of this with Philly's takeout initiative in mind. What are the potential risks of framing a public health effort around a specific group? And why do it that way if you could do it a different way? And there's another layer here, the people eating the food. In this case, the Chinese takeout initiative is focused on improving the health of Black and Latino Philadelphians. African Americans do have higher rates of hypertension than whites in the city, but there are a million other things that could be contributing to that.
It's much easier to lecture people about what they're supposed to eat than it is to change conditions of structural inequality.
Sarah is talking about the other factors in people's lives that can cause high blood pressure, up your risk for heart attacks or strokes. For one, chronic stress is linked to those health risks. Living in poverty, which a quarter of Philadelphians do, is a huge stressor. Violence is another big one. More and more, public health experts are looking beyond people's individual choices and pointing to community-level forces that affect health. They're asking other questions, too, like, Do low-income Black and Latino residents have the political power to lobby for healthy, affordable food in their neighborhood? If the answer is no, that might help explain the takeout signs lining the avenues in West Philly. But food historian Sarah Tracy acknowledges that those are complicated problems to entangle.
It's easier to say, oh, you need to take some sodium out of your Chinese restaurant takeout.
Philly public health officials say that part of why they like this program so much is that they have a great relationship with the local Chinese Restaurant Association, which is well organized and easy to work with. Often for public health initiatives, buy-in from the community is key. And this takeout initiative is just one strategy. Philadelphia also recently passed legislation that will make it mandatory to put warning labels on menu items with high sodium. But the public health department is sticking with the Chinese restaurant approach. Next, they're launching a project focused on Chinese buffets.
That was Nina Feldman reporting. Coming up, reverse engineering a perfect London cup of tea.
After conducting a series of analytical tests on the water, they were able to discover all the components of that water, all the different minerals that were contained in that water, and the proportions of those minerals within the water.
And this is tea for the king and queen, no less. Still to come on The Pulse.
Supporting The Pulse, the Coriell Institute for Medical Research, enabling scientific discovery around the world through its renowned collections of cell lines and DNA from the National Institute on Aging and National Institute for General Medical Sciences. Learn more at coriell.org.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about ingredients, what's in our medications, food and drinks. Americans spend billions of dollars on bottled water. Water is now a bigger seller than carbonated soft drinks. In part, the water market is driven by consumer fears about the safety of tap water. People are worried about hidden ingredients like lead or other chemicals. But then, choosing a specific water is also about flavor preferences. Not all water is created equal. Caitlin Swaljay reports.
Martin Reza patrols the floor of the Patina restaurant in downtown Los Angeles. As patrons are seated for dinner, Martin greets them with a flurry of questions. Dry or sweet? Carbonated or still? Smooth or gritty? However, Martin is not asking about wine. His field of expertise is water, spring water to be specific.
So we have here now Vichy Catalan from Barcelona, a little bit northern of Barcelona actually. So this is loaded with minerals. It is a little bit on the saltier side. It's a very, very famous spirit. So I have them all in room temperature because I can taste more aromas out of room temperature waters versus extremely chilled waters. My name is Martin Reese. I'm a certified water sommelier and I like to hydrate Americans.
His love for water started decades ago on a trip across Europe with his parents.
And it was fascinating that the tap water tasted differently in every single city in Europe. And my parents always thought, like, why is he so thirsty? But for me, it was not just about drinking. It was about tasting water as a child.
Fast forward, and Martin Reese now hosts water tasting classes. He's written a book about water and even created a 45-page bottled water menu with waters from all over the world.
In the restaurant business, it's all about options. You have different wines, you have different beers, you have different liquors. But when it comes to water, our most important beverage in our lives, the server will ask you, yeah, do you want sparkling, flat or tap? They don't even tell you which brand they are serving. And I thought I need to change that.
He's quick to admit how silly his profession sounds to people unfamiliar with the world of water tasting.
A lot of people always think, like, come on, it's water, huh? There's a water sommelier, this should be so easy, huh? I want that job too.
But Martin hopes that by getting people's attention, he can hook them into a larger and more important conversation about water conservation and access to clean water.
When they think it's completely nuts and crazy what I'm doing, that's totally fine as well. I'm always telling these people who think like water has no taste and it's all the same, just come over here to the restaurant, have a little water tasting with me, a little water exercise, and trust me, you will see the difference. Everybody can taste the difference in water.
Transparent, colorless, and odorless, water all looks the same. But it's what's inside, invisible to the eye, that makes one glass taste different than the next.
People don't understand that every bottled water is not just H2O, H2O plus minerals.
That mix of water and minerals often starts with a rainstorm.
So my rainwater falls on the land surface.
This is Dr. Dorothy Vesper, professor of geology at West Virginia University, an expert on all things underground and all things water.
The water that lands on the land surface can infiltrate very slowly through the soil, through the rock layers, and come very slowly into the subsurface.
And just as slowly, the water begins to eat away at that rock bed.
And as it dissolves the rock away, the water picks up the chemistry and the character of the rock.
And finally, H2O, now loaded with minerals, breaks the surface in the form of a spring. So all these parameters, the kind of rock, whether it's granite or limestone, how easily that rock dissolves in water, and finally how long the rainwater flows underground, all these things together affect the flavor profile of spring water. Water sommelier Martin Risa knows the range of flavors nature can produce.
I tasted so far around over 1,000 different spring waters from around the world. A water from a volcanic region has more minerals than a water from sandstones. I had one water taste like coconuts, but it was not a coconut water. I had one water that tastes like rhubarb. It was really the taste of rhubarbs, and I was like fascinated and then like going nuts about this water. I was like, I cannot even believe that why this water tastes rhubarb. Mother Nature can give us different taste profiles.
Some of the bottles on Martin's water menu sell for as much as $150. So on one hand, you could look at this as a luxury market, profiting from the bottling of a limited resource. But on the other hand, Martin says his goal is to convince people that water is a valuable natural resource, worth protecting.
When people are telling me, do you know what, Martin, that was really a mind-opening experience. Because then I achieved exactly that what I want, that people starting to value water more. And maybe these people will go home, and when they're taking their shower, they might be thinking, oh, it's water, maybe I shouldn't take my shower too long because we need to save water. Or maybe when they're washing their teeth, stop the tap and then open the tap again when you actually need the water. So this is the whole point for me, to really help people to understand that water is not just water, that we need to honor water, that we need to save water, and I think that we need to help people to get access to clean and safe drinking water.
That was Caitlin Swaljay reporting. Water played a starring role during a royal visit. In 1939, King George VI and his wife, Queen Elizabeth, were traveling to the United States.
This is the first time in history that ruling British monarchs have ever set foot in the capital of the nation that once formed a part of their empire.
The royals came at the invitation of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
To a meeting that is one of the highlights of current history, when the ruling heads of the world's two greatest democracies stand face to face.
With the world at the brink of war, both countries were interested in establishing closer ties. FDR and First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt planned every part of this visit, down to the smallest details, and some scientists stepped up to help out.
There was a group of Philadelphia chemists who learned from a magazine article that the King and Queen of England had an aversion to tea which was brewed from any other water other than the water they were accustomed to in London.
This is Patrick Shea. He is chief curator of archives at the Science History Institute in Philadelphia. He says the chemists worked for a company called WH and LD Betts Incorporated.
They were a water conditioning firm, so they were purifying water for city drinking water in Philadelphia and other manufacturing processes.
The royal tea was usually made with London city water, which came from the Thames, and the Philly chemists were confident that they could manufacture or recreate that water in the U.S.
They sent a letter to the White House, to Eleanor Roosevelt specifically, told them that they believed that they could accomplish this and wondered if they would be interested in receiving such a sample of synthetically manufactured London water.
The Science History Institute has the archives of the Betts Company, and they contain the return letter from the First Lady.
The first one is simply a letter from Eleanor Roosevelt to a Mr. Ross at the firm Betts.
My dear Mr. Ross, you were very kind to offer to analyze the London water and send us a supply of the product of your laboratory. I accept your offer with gratitude. Very sincerely yours, Eleanor Roosevelt.
So, the Betts chemists requested a water sample from London. They analyzed it.
After conducting a series of analytical tests on the water, they were able to discover all the components of that water, all the different minerals that were contained in that water, and the proportions of those minerals within the water.
They went to the Schuylkill River in Philadelphia, got some water from there, distilled it, and then added minerals in the same exact proportions as London water. They sent their sample to the White House and received an order to produce several gallons, which they delivered. A few weeks later, the First Lady expressed her gratitude.
Finally, this last letter is dated June 9, 1939. This is after the King and Queen had already left. Eleanor Roosevelt writes, My dear Mr. Betts,
I am writing to express my thanks to your firm for the specially fabricated water which Mr. Ross delivered personally for our use during the visit of the King and Queen. You were very kind to take so much trouble to duplicate the London city water and to supply it to us in such generous quantities, and I want you to know how much your services are appreciated. Very sincerely yours, Eleanor Roosevelt.
We don't know how much the royals enjoyed the tea itself or if they noticed all of this effort, but we do like to think that science was a key ingredient in supporting diplomacy. We started out this episode studying food labels with chemist Katie Hunt, and she says from sugar to milk to methosulfate,
everything around us is chemicals.
And she says rather than getting freaked out by their long and sometimes complicated names, we should get to know them.
I sometimes think of chemicals as people, because they're all kinds of people, and most people are really wonderful. And some you really have to struggle to get to know. And I think that's really how it is with chemicals.
And this effort could really pay off.
When you asked me about reading these labels, I started thinking, yeah, there's so much we don't get about what's in our food and what it does to our bodies and how we can be really good to ourselves by really reading labels and understanding what they mean and how we can use that to our better health.
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu and Liz Tong. Julian Harris is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Alex Stern is our associate producer. Tanya English, our editorial director. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral Health Reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated health care.
WHYY's Health and Science Reporting is supported by a generous grant from Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.